On this week's 51%, meet a woman who, after a career in TV, made her first feature-length documentary, and Dr. Jerry Burns tells a seasonal story.
A change in tradition does not equate with a break.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Bonnie Hawthorne's documentary, Dreaming of a Better World, is about a visionary Nebraska farm family who understood that modern agriculture was ailing and found a cure. From farmer's son to soil scientist to missionary, and back to farmer, organic pioneer David Vetter has dedicated his life to a ministry to the soil. So with camera and camper in tow, Hawthorne leaves her urban comforts in the rearview mirror to learn from the Vetters about what's really going on in the Corn Belt. As interest in regenerating soil explodes worldwide, Hawthorne discovers that David Vetter is way ahead of the game. Dreaming of a Better World shows it's possible to jump off conventional agriculture's pesticide treadmill. It's also a story about love, hope, and place, an example of perseverance and doing what you know is right against the odds. But first we need to back up when the seed for her documentary was planted, but she didn't even know it. It was during a chance encounter in 2004 in Zion National Park in Utah, where Hawthorne met Reverend Molly Vetter, one of the youngest ordained Methodist ministers at age 26 in the country. They stayed in touch, became Facebook friends, and Hawthorne learned through Facebook about the Vetter family farm in Nebraska. I caught up with Hawthorne at the Woodstock Film Festival in the fall, where her film was screened for its East Coast premiere.
I went out just on a little fact-finding mission to Nebraska and just fell in love with them, fell in love with the Great Plains, and gradually started learning about agriculture. And I was coming at it from the perspective of a city girl, which is what Donald, his father, was always saying. Like, he would just roll his eyes at me when I'd ask a stupid question and just say, "Ugh, you're such a city girl."
Wait, stop. How did that make you feel?
It was absolutely right. I am. But I feel like that is why this film is good. Because, you know, you're learning with me. The audience is learning with me, the filmmaker and narrator.
It was the fact you were from the city.
Right.
It wasn't the fact you were female.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
I want to
be clear about
that.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Okay.
No, and he meant it with love, but if you know anyone from the Midwest, they're super wry. You know, they have a sense of humor, but it's wry, like, bordering on mean sometimes, you know, like
quietly dark.
somebody asked David Vetter what he thinks of the film, and he said, "Turned out better than I expected." And you know, from in a Midwesterner is like, "Ooh, that's 5 stars. That's high praise."
So let's talk about this from, so we know how you came upon the subject matter. I don't want to give everything away because it's a worthwhile documentary to see. You did almost everything. We were just talking before. You did almost everything on this film, minus two jobs, right?
Minus three jobs. I did everything but the music, graphics, and the audio mix. I did everything else.
Why?
Well, for one thing, money. That's the main reason. And because I could. I mean, really, you know. I learned so much in the process. And one of the things I learned is don't ever do that again. But I didn't have any money. I ended up living in my little camper, my little 15-foot tab trailer for 2 years.
For this movie.
Yeah.
For this film.
Like sleeping in Walmart parking lots and campgrounds and the whole thing.
Was it worth it?
Yeah. It was fun. I mean, I had been working in reality television as an editor for a long time, and I was just burned out. I was just over it. And I bought this little trailer when I was in Montana working on Mountain Men, and the little trailer really changed my life because it's like suddenly I was free, you know? I wasn't stuck in the city. I could go out to Joshua Tree National Park, which is not very far from Los Angeles. I now live in Joshua Tree full time. But this little trailer, Petunia is her name, inspired so much change in my life. And so I had just finished a job in Dallas. I had the trailer with me. The job went horribly, horribly wrong. It was terrible. And so I got Petunia, headed north to Nebraska, and started shooting this film.
Now, there's a quote in the program here at the Woodstock Film Festival about you saying you're, I think it was film professor at NYU.
Oh, in
was
my
that
bio.
Very tongue-in-cheek?
Yeah, that's completely made up. Okay. But the truth is, when I was in NYU, we're talking mid-80s, and I went to be a cinematographer, and women were not welcome in the camera department at that time. And there's good reason. At that time, cameras were big and heavy, and you wore a big, heavy battery belt that was almost like what you wear sea diving. You know, those weight belts with batteries.
Yeah, I scuba dive. I know
yeah,
exactly what
exactly.
You're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And there was a day when I was shooting something in St. John the Divine Church in Manhattan, and I had an Aeroflex camera on my shoulder and this giant battery pack around my waist, and I'm leaning over this rickety railing, shooting a shot on the floor below, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm not sure I'm going to want to do this when I'm 50. Well, now cameras are tiny, and, you know, the batteries are tiny, and...
But you think that was the sole reason, was the heavy lifting involved?
Well, no. They didn't want women, just because they're...
It was a good way to say no.
So, you know, I worked as a second camera assistant in film, which meant I was the loader. When you're a second camera assistant, your job is really stressful because if you mess up how that magazine is loaded, you've just messed up a very expensive commercial. So it's super stressful. And then the guys in the camera department made it worse because they just ran me ragged. And then at the end of it, a few of them said, you know, in case you haven't figured it out, you are not welcome here. Go get a chick job like editing. Because at that time, Dee Dee Allen, you know, there were lots of top female editors because at that time it was a really tedious job. It was like sewing, you know, on a steam back where you're actually cutting and
actually
taping
together. Exactly. Arts and crafts. It's
yeah.
Arts and crafts.
Yeah.
Right?
So then when it became digital in the 90s with Avid, then of course all the guys got interested in it and now it's a dude job, but whatever. That's how I became an editor. I wanted to be a cinematographer. So I always wanted to shoot a film. And when the Vetter idea came up, I just bought some Blackmagic pocket cinema cameras that are very small cameras, and they're 1080. So, I mean, I should have got... At the time, 4K was just coming onto the market, so whatever. 1080 is good enough for right now.
So you're living in Petunia.
Mm-hmm. so you're living
funny.
In Petunia.
That sounded... Nobody will know what that is. So you're living in Petunia. You've mm-hmm. decided you're going with this. This is fascinating subject matter, and you're able to access the subjects involved. Mm-hmm. So here you are. You're doing all these jobs, minus three, and you're a woman in a man's world, it appeared to me, mm-hmm. Until you pointed out about halfway through who's the backbone of all of this. But did you ever feel that you were any discrimination, even very subconsciously on the part of someone? Did you feel that anyone was aware this is a woman doing this film, not a man?
No. Any discrimination that I experienced while I was working in the Midwest was because I was from California.
Geographic discrimination.
And because I was a city girl.
You had just had no trouble getting them to talk, it seemed.
I felt like after... Well, so Donald Vetter, the father, was suspicious of me at first. I remember him saying to David, what does she want? What is she after?
Soil.
And he said, I don't know, and I don't think she knows. Because I didn't. I honestly didn't know what the story was. I knew there was a story because David Vetter and his father, Donald, were agricultural pioneers. You know, they're the reason we have organic popcorn. You know, because in the early days of organic, we had organic produce, we had organic dairy, we didn't have organic grain. And so David Vetter saw this market niche and went back to Nebraska, and he and his dad created this.
No, it's a fascinating story. It really is. People don't know who's behind everything that we're doing today, in a sense.
Right. But when I went into this, because of the whole Oregon wheat field thing, I thought I was making a film about GMOs. And so I would say to David, well, so what about GMOs? And he'd say, well, first of all, GMOs is not a real term. It's genetic engineering, or actually transgenic, like gently kind of correcting me into, you know, a more precise way of looking at things. And then somehow the conversation always kind of turned to soil. And it took me the longest time to figure out what he was saying to me. Not because he was obtuse, it was more because I just wasn't getting it. He was very gentle and very, you know, persistent. And finally, when I was editing, I was like, oh, that's what he's talking about. This is the key to everything.
And then you realize, well, this is the path we're going on for this film. This is where it is.
Yeah.
There's a point in the film, more or less halfway, maybe a little more than halfway, where you point out that the women are responsible. You know, the subjects of the film are male. You've got David, you've Donald, and some of the neighbors. So the point is, it's all men.
Right.
And then at some point in the film, you said, you know, there are women responsible for the right. success of what you're doing.
And that's true for almost every farm.
And so what made you come, how did you get to that point in the film?
It was actually David's daughter, Allison, who said, you know, my mom needs to be in this film. And so we did that interview at her insistence, because I was trying to very gently avoid the whole topic because of her illness. And then I realized, yeah, no, this is the key to everything. She's the key to everything in that family.
Do you feel you featured it enough?
I featured it as much as I could. You know, there's no footage of her, very, very few photos. You know, it's like their generation and where they live, it's not like today where you have a bunch of photos. You know, everybody's lives are so well recorded now. They weren't that way, especially on a farm, you know, back in the 50s.
That makes sense. I was wondering.
Yeah.
And that now I completely understand. Now that you've made this film, and you do have, you did have a little star power behind it, we should mention.
A little bit.
It's not to take away anything.
Steve Buscemi is my executive producer. That's what she's hinting about.
I almost don't even want to say it because I don't want to take away from your accomplishment.
Steve Buscemi, Mr. Pink. Yeah. He and his wife, Jo Andres, are old friends from when I was at NYU in the mid-80s. They were my neighbors. That's how I know them. And they were both involved in the performance art scene in New York, and I was just this dopey film student who lived next door. Because really, anybody working in the arts in New York in the 80s thought NYU students were lame. And I don't know if it's that way today, but, you know, it's like, oh, you're a film student? Kind of thing. So we were next-door neighbors, and we've just been friends ever since. And Jo, his wife, has made several films. She's a really excellent filmmaker and choreographer. So she was my, like, cheerleader, mentor, tour mentor. So, I mean, when I say that I did everything on this film except for the music, the graphics, and the audio mix, it's not entirely true. I had a lot of support, moral support, people reading scripts, so many people.
Feedback.
Yeah, and then in the editing process, I had a lot of test screenings at my house, and Joshua Tree community like came out in force, 6 people at a time.
So now that you've done this,
yeah,
and you're kind of taking your own direction rather than someone else's, and doing the cinematography, doing what you wanted to do, not in the editing, well, editing too, but you know, what do you think of? Is this your new path?
I mean, I hope so, because honestly, I feel like I went to film school again and got a graduate degree in, you know, real filmmaking. Because, you know, working as an editor in television, I would show up with my little, you know, bag on my shoulder, my little coffee, and be like, so how come my clips aren't grouped, guys? You know, these poor assistant editors who've been there all night and they've been having crashes and they're just like bleary-eyed, and I walk in like ready to work and I'm like, you know. Well, now I've been the assistant editor. I've also been the director. I've you know, now I have appreciate what everybody's jobs are because I had to do them. So I learned an awful lot, and it seems like it would be a waste not to make more films. now that I've learned stuff. The main thing I've learned is you need to get money before you start making a film. Because I didn't do that. I just made a film.
Well, it sounds like it happened so happenstance. These things happen. But yet you will raise money ahead of time the next time.
I would like to, for sure. Because living on credit cards is, you know, it's a really bad idea. It all kind of worked out. I did get amazing support from Dr. Bronner's Soaps and Patagonia and others. Harrison Bird Foods, Mega Food. So, and locally, Robert Kalin. I don't know if you know him. He lives here in the Hudson Valley. So I've had amazing support. I've had, you know, just, I can't, one of my executive producers, Bobby Houston, said that the most important thing to make a film is community. And I had no idea what he was talking about. Really, but it, you know, I didn't do this all by myself. I had a lot of people along the way helping me.
What's your advice to young female filmmakers who want to kind of do what you're doing?
Raise money first.
And second?
So what I would say is don't be afraid to be pushy. You know, don't be afraid to elbow your way in.
What surprised you in making this film? Was there something that just really took you aback?
It really surprised me that a lot of what we call conventional farmers, and to be really blunt, that means farmers who use chemicals. That is what conventional agriculture is. And more people are understanding what that means with this recent glyphosate lawsuit where the man was awarded a $289 million, you know, who knows if he'll ever see a penny of it, but it brought the word glyphosate into a lot of people's consciousness. Where when I started making this film, very few people knew about glyphosate or atrazine or 2,4-D or dicamba or any of these chemicals that are used more and more and more. I mean, dicamba is wiping out crops all across the Midwest because they have genetically engineered crops not to die when sprayed with this stuff. But if your conventional farmer neighbor hasn't planted those crops, you're killing his crops, and it's a disaster. And so what surprised me was how few of those farmers have even heard of organic. Now, here in Woodstock, it's like everybody, you know, you walk down the street and there's...
Organitown.
It's totally Organitown. I love it. But you go to Nebraska, and there's a family in the film that never even knew about organic till 2008, when somebody came knocking on their door and said, hey, do you want to switch over and grow some organic blue corn? I mean, the way they tell the story in real life is really funny because the son says, what the hell is blue corn? And the dad says, what the hell is organic? 2008, so that's 10 years ago. And the reason they were picked was because they were growing conventional alfalfa, but there was no genetically modified alfalfa at that point. So they were able to convert their ground to organic, get certified right away. Whereas it takes a farm 3 years, if it's been a conventional farm using chemicals, it takes 3 years to go to the process to become organic. So that's the thing that surprised me most, was how little knowledge there is of the people growing our food about what it is they're growing.
So that's frightening. So does this make you think, like, I want to continue in this vein and do more on this topic?
Yes and no. So I have a whole, like, stockpile of amazing interviews with amazing thinkers in agriculture that, you know, I ought to do something with, but...
Haven't figured out what yet.
I haven't figured it out. And I also have to get funding to do it because I'm not going to...
Money first.
Money first, girls.
That was Bonnie Hawthorne. She is director, cinematographer, editor, writer, and narrator of her first documentary, Dreaming of a Vetter World. And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns illuminates a seasonal topic.
Our storyteller and writer friend, Jack McGuire, gave my husband Barry and me a set of blue glass candlesticks when we got married, and from that point onward, we've had candlelit suppers every day. We added other candles to the mix when we bought a chandelier that uses candles instead of light bulbs. It's hung over the dining room table like a twinkling crown over our meals. Our son, home from college recently, sat at the table for the first time in that visit, looked around and murmured, "Candlelit dinners." It's a beloved family tradition. In winter, our dining room is even more fiery. Pottery and brass candles of different creatures, like a dove, cat, angel, and a rocking horse, polka dot the dining room like tiny nighttime stars. But to top it off, Barry and I were raised in different religious traditions, so we also have Hanukkah and Advent candles. Our dining room is warm, bright, and twinkling at the darkest time of year. We also celebrate different holidays. Latkes and rum-drenched fruitcake permeate the air and fill our bellies. And for our gut health, thankfully, only once a year, thank you. Like every family, we have our holiday traditions. One annual tradition that Barry loves is listening to a radio broadcast of a festival of 9 lessons and carols from King's College in Cambridge, England. Not only does he have some English heritage, Barry lived in England for a time and attended the festival in person while he was there. For all these reasons, he feels a strong connection to the annual radio program. We listen to the broadcast every year in some capacity on Christmas Eve morning, on our way to this gig or that last-minute errand, or quietly at home. Last year, he scheduled his time so that he didn't have to go on an errand, but could devote his entire morning to the service. He sat by the fire, sipped his tea, what else, and listened. I was making pecan pie in the kitchen, another holiday staple, while listening from afar. This broadcast tells the Christmas story about the birth of Christ, interspersed with traditional carols and hymns, and every section of scripture is read by a different person. I was in the middle of creating a geometric shape of pecans to decorate the center of my pie when I heard something I was surprised to hear. I heard an accent coming from the speakers, but it wasn't an English accent. I walked into the living room a little while later, remembering that surprising moment when Barry looked up and said, "Believe it or not, the Church of England just made a statement." He said that in all the years he's listened, he's never noticed non-English people reading the scripture. But last year, in addition to English accents, other accents were part of the reading. I noticed it too, and it was wonderful. The broadcast, without saying anything directly, without lambasting or grandstanding, demonstrated inclusivity. This was an important statement at this very challenging time in the world, where nationalism has stridently arisen against a tide of immigration. This choice touched me. But what touched me even more is that they just did it. In times where people talk about all the good they plan to do, it is so refreshing when people simply walk the talk without talking about it. So, does this mean that the 9 Lessons and Carols program is no longer traditional? Does this type of change represent a break with tradition? Some might argue that's the case, but it's not how I see it. A change in tradition does not equate with a break. Change is how traditions are built and perpetuated into the future. It's kind of like how we build tradition in our family. We started with dinner candles. We added a chandelier. And once our son came along, Hanukkah and Advent candles came too. Additions don't have to mean a break with tradition. Rather, additions can build up traditions and strengthen them. Like candles enrich the dinner tradition in our winter dining room.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She is co-author of the recently published book, Story Twisting, A Guide to Remixing and Reinventing Stories. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1534.